Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click.
Click, 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 click.
Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
For all the young venture capitalists out there, I didn't do a single investment for 2 years.
Didn't you start feeling like a pressure to make a deal?
Of course, but I wasn't going to do anything I didn't believe in because for me, I was still an entrepreneur. I hadn't converted to being a venture capitalist. And to be an entrepreneur, it's about build. I didn't look at these things as investments.
Welcome to the Startupable Show. This is our first episode, and I couldn't be more grateful to start with such an incredible guest. Today, I had Kevin Efrusi on the show. Kevin joined Accel Partners in 2003 and was the lead investor in companies like Groupon, Couchbase, and Facebook, which is likely one of the best venture investments
of all time.
The story of how he leveraged a prepared mind, source, Facebook, and convinced Mark Zuckerberg in 2005 to accept the Accel deal earned him a feature in Sebastian Smalaby's famous book, The Power Law. Why was arguably one of the best venture investments in history such a low point for you?
Well, it reminded me that I wasn't an entrepreneur. And they were, because it was really after that that I saw they were having all the fun. They were building this company, it was growing quickly, and I'm the investor guy.
Kevin also began Accel's Latin America initiatives, leading to investments in companies such as Despegar, Gympass, Nubem Shop, and Quinto Andar. He has been a significant supporter of LATAM's startup ecosystem since its early days.
10 years ago, 2010, this was unimaginable. So I'm pretty excited. I feel like we built something, and from where I sit, the ecosystem is beyond my wildest dreams for where it would be.
Personally investing in two of the leading venture capital funds in the region, like Kasek and Monashis, and helping multiple other founders.
You know, why did I do Latin America? Essentially because it feels like building something again, building the region, building an ecosystem.
We discussed what a prepared mind is in venture.
Which was to say, hey, what are we looking for? What do we think is going to happen? What do we think the next set of technologies are going to be, or the next set of companies? And what's going to make them successful? And have an idea so that when we see one that matches that, we can move very quickly and with conviction.
How investing in Facebook shaped his investment philosophy and him personally.
Facebook, I was the highest valuation it was done at the time. People who called up my friends at the firm and said, what happened to Kevin? Why'd you let him do that deal? That was fucking ridiculous. You know, and again, I thought like, okay, so if I get fired, maybe that's even great.
And why he has been dedicating more time to philanthropy rather than venture capital as a means of giving back.
Look, we've done well. We've made more money than we could spend. And we do want to make the world better. I mean, that was why I wanted to be an entrepreneur.
I left feeling touched and energized by Kevin's generosity. His attitude towards giving back is unmatched. Please enjoy this great discussion with Kevin Efrusi. Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Gracias.
Welcome, and thanks. We initially thought about doing this in Spanish, but we're going to do it in English, because I think there's so much wisdom. I don't want language to intervene in your capacity.
Maybe a phrase or two I'll throw in some Spanish just to prove up to you a little bit.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. So let's start with a bit of a backstory. Tell us, how did you make your way into the fascinating world of startups?
I grew up in Chicago, and always, for some reason, when I was young, reading stories of the early Silicon Valley, which at that time was actually Silicon. There were computer chip companies and computer companies. And I wanted to be an entrepreneur. So my dream was to study engineering or physics at Stanford, and then someday hopefully use that knowledge to go start a company. And that's what happened. I was lucky because it was much easier to get into Stanford back in 1990. In fact, there was a large earthquake in 1989 in San Francisco in the region. It destroyed a lot of buildings and scared a lot of people away from applying to Stanford because the earthquake was very close to Stanford, actually damaged a lot of the buildings. So it was the easiest year to get into Stanford in probably 20 years before and 20 years and forever since. So just to give an idea, back then, the acceptance rate into Stanford was about, I think, 18% or 20%. So one out of every five people would get in. It's now 3%. Two, So now it's like 2 out of every 100 people get it. So it was much easier back then. And it was still a good school, but it wasn't as internationally famous. It was more for geeks like me. It was for people who wanted to do something different. You know, all of the people who wanted to go somewhere famous wanted to go to Harvard or Yale or Princeton. And people who went to Stanford at that time were a little different. You know, technology wasn't considered a big popular field. It wasn't considered a great way to make money. It was just for certain geeks.
It wasn't mainstream as it is today.
Yeah, it wasn't mainstream at all. So if you wanted to get rich, you went to New York and worked on Wall Street or became a lawyer or even a doctor. So it was very different. So I went there and studied engineering. Physics was too hard. You know, and then wound up working for right out of school for a consulting firm called Bain and Company for a couple of years. Didn't enjoy that, but that led me to my first startup, you know, because I was accepted back into Stanford Business School a couple of years later. And while I was waiting to go, I had kind of 9 months and I didn't want to spend 9 more months doing consulting. I figured, you know, it was better to learn something. This was the early days of the internet. So this is 1996. You know, the Mosaic browser, the first web browser came out in 93. So, you know, Mark Andreessen at University of Illinois. So this was still early days. And so, but I wanted to join one of these companies. So I wound up getting a job with a startup called Zip2 that turned out to be Elon Musk's first company, though no one knew who Elon Musk was then. He wasn't even the CEO. He was the founder and the chief technology officer. You know, I was a junior product manager there for about, I don't know, 9 months. And learned a lot, used to have a lot of late night arguments with Elon, as everyone in the company did, because he was just as stubborn and difficult, but also brilliant then as he is now. And then went to Stanford Business School with the whole goal to find a company to start or someone to start a company with those couple of years. This is a quick story I'll tell just to show that you can't plan everything in life. You have to allow for serendipity to happen in life, meaning the random chance, right? And so I wanted to start a company, so I was going to look for anything to start a company. So the summer job I had accepted and was offered was actually at a place called Los Alamos National Laboratories. And if you've seen the movie Oppenheimer, that's what it is. If Oppenheimer started Los Alamos National Labs, it was a nuclear weapons research laboratory. And there are several of those around the US now. But the job was to show up there, and they had, in the process of developing these weapons, they developed all kinds of really cool technologies. And they wanted to commercialize some to see, hey, you know, not nuclear stuff, but things around health and communications and imaging and all this cool stuff. And hey, we have all these great things. You want to be an entrepreneur? You're at Stanford Business School. Why don't you come spend the summer, meet all the researchers, see if there's any cool things. And if you like one, we'll license it to you, grab the research, go start a company. And maybe you'll start it in New Mexico and help our economy. And I thought this was a dream, right? For an entrepreneur, you know, because the hardest part is the idea. And I was about to take that job. And then 2 weeks before I was supposed to start, I got a call from a venture capital firm called Kleiner Perkins that was looking for a summer person to work with a partner there named Vinod Khosla, who now is his own firm, long story. Vinod was even famous back then because he had started a company called Sun Microsystems, which became a very big sort of computer company back in the 80s. So the job was to work with him because he supposedly had an idea for a company he wanted to start, and he wanted some young person to work with him, research it, write a business plan, maybe start the company. And I thought, well, that's okay. That's a pretty good job. Kleiner Perkins at that time was considered, you know, the best venture capital firm in the world. How could I turn this down? But funny story, the only reason they called me was because I was one of two people. And this just shows you that time. I was one of two students at Stanford Business School at that time who had any experience in an internet company. There were just two of us. Because remember, the internet started basic. You know, Amazon didn't start till 1994. This is now 1997. So to go to business school with any experience in an internet company was impossible. I was lucky because I basically quit. I took those 9 months and said, instead of staying for that Bain and just, you know, I want to do something different. And it was that luck and that intellectual curiosity that allowed me to have the experience that then they called me. And there was only one other kid and they gave the job to me. So I had a 50% chance, you know, that was it. And then I worked with Vinod. It turns out there really wasn't much of an idea, but I wound up starting a company called Corio, which before there was what we call SaaS today, software as a service, that word didn't exist back then, but this was sort of the first version of that. And we called them ASPs, application services providers. You would take existing software that in those days ran inside a data center and you try to deliver it. Started that company and then, you know, went back to finish business school. That company wound up going public, started. And I said, I want to do this again. And Kleiner Perkins said, well, why don't you work for us as an venture capitalist? And I said, that sounds awful. I hate what you do. I'd much rather be an entrepreneur. I'd like to start another company. And they said, great. And so they gave me an office and said, we'll fund whatever you want to do. Wound up starting a second company or working with actually an entrepreneur who was his original idea. Named Reza Bundy and started a company called Iron Planet with him. You know, that wound up doing okay. You know, it took a long time, kind of grew slowly, but wound up doing okay. You know, it was bought for about $750 million, but not for like 14 or 15 years later. But I didn't stay the whole time. And then after a few years, this is important to realize, after I left Iron Planet in 2001, and 2001 was a very, very difficult time in the technology business. It was worse than now. It was really, really hard. Just to give you an idea, everyone was moving out of the Bay Area. There were no, you couldn't get a trailer to move your stuff to leave the Bay Area. They were all gone because everyone had moved to Seattle, to San Diego, Los Angeles, wherever. And because the technology business was a wreck, because all of the internet companies had, there's a dot-com bust, it all gone, you know. So you really couldn't start one. So I went back to Kleiner Perkins and said, I'd love to start another company. They said, we're not funding any companies this year. Zero. We have 50 companies that we funded the past two or three years that we're trying to fix. You could work on one of those and try to fix them. And I did that a little bit. I was like, these are terrible. I mean, most of them were just bad ideas in the overfunded, kind of like what we see now, right? When people raise too much money, they didn't have a business plan. And around that time, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was married and I was about almost 30 years old. And my wife was pregnant with our first child and we needed health insurance. And what do you do, right? And it was really, really difficult. No one was hiring. You couldn't get a job at Microsoft. You couldn't get a job at, you know, Symantec. I mean, these software, I just wanted to be a product manager in a software company. Could not, no one was hiring. And then Excel called me because they had been an investor in Iron Planet. The founder of Excel was on my board. They knew me. Several of the partners there had worked at Bain with me and knew me. So they said, hey, why don't you come be a venture capitalist? And I said, I need to be 40 years old and an experienced entrepreneur? And they said, no, we think actually that model isn't the right model. We think it takes about 7 to 10 years to learn what you're doing as a venture capitalist. And, you know, so you want to start when you're young and you want to start when the cycle is really bad because 2001, it's really bad. At the time, all the newspapers said venture capital was dead, Silicon Valley was dead, the model was broken. Those were the headlines. In 2001, Silicon Valley was dead, venture capital was dead. And they said, no, it's a cycle. It'll come back. It's about a 16, 18 year cycle. And so you want to start now. So by the time you learn what you're doing.
Sounds a bit similar to some of the headlines we see in media outlets in Latin America, especially, which probably is our first experience going through a bust like this.
Right. Well, you go through busts every 3 years, but it's more macroeconomic. The technology cycle is longer. And so, you know, I didn't believe him at the time, to be honest, about the cycle and everything. The truth was I really had no other job and my wife was pregnant and they were going to pay me a lot of money. And so I took it and I hated it every day for the first really couple of years. I was going to quit every 6 months for my first couple of years. And I would tell my wife, okay, I can't do this anymore. We're going to, you know, because it was just not what I enjoyed. I enjoyed building things. And this was about meeting dozens of entrepreneurs every week and saying no, because most of the ideas were pretty bad. And it's just miserable. So I didn't do a single investment my first 2 years. So for all the young venture capitalists out there, I didn't do a single investment for 2 years. Not one. Because they weren't any good. I actually think I tried to do one or two, and the firm thought they were too terrible and wouldn't do it. So, but really, I didn't do it. I brought in a couple of deals that we should have done, like Skype and some things that I wanted to do, but it didn't happen. And so I was determined after that didn't happen that if I found something I really wanted to do, I was going to make us do it, even if they were going to fire me. Like we were just, you know, because at that point, I didn't love the job very much.
Didn't you start feeling like a pressure to make a deal?
Of course. But I wasn't going to do anything I didn't believe in, because for me, I was still an entrepreneur. I hadn't converted to being a venture capitalist. And to be an entrepreneur, it's about build. I didn't look at these things as investments. So other partners would refer to them as deals or as projects. To me, they were companies. You're building something, right? And so I had to be passionate about what we were going to build. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And you go, well, why? I mean, it's an investment. You're not doing it. The entrepreneur's doing it. Man, when you're doing early stage investing, it is a commitment. And, you know, all the conversations and the late night phone calls and the, you know, trying to raise money and help them think through and dealing with all the difficult stuff, it's an emotional journey. And you have to believe, you know, and if you don't believe in the company, the entrepreneur, it's never going to succeed. It's not like picking a stock where you just buy the stock and hope it goes up. I mean, you are in the trenches with them. So you got to believe it. And so I didn't find anything I believed in, you know, and it was really difficult because it was just coming out of the, and I know now why. It's because the new platform had not emerged yet. And every cycle in the technology business is driven by one or more platforms. In other words, new technologies that then enable the rest of the companies to be built. In the 1960s, just to give you an example, this was semiconductors, right? So the transistor was invented in 1957 in Bell Labs in, I think, New Jersey, at AT&T Labs. And the transistor is what enabled the whole microchip revolution in electronics. So, you know, you couldn't have a little radio until you had the transistor. And eventually, so there was a whole big boom in the 1960s. And then that kind of crashed. And then the microprocessor was invented at Intel in 1971 or two. And that paved the way for the next boom, which was computers, right? That went through the 70s, Microsoft, Corel, all the Compaq, Apple, all those companies, 70s to early 80s, Lotus, and then that crashed, you know, through the 80s. And then what was the next big boom? The internet. So that was enabled by the Cisco infrastructure and the Mosaic web browser, and they had all the internet companies. And now that crashed, and I was sitting there right after that crash, and basically the new platform hadn't emerged yet. This is 2003 when I started at Excel, and there was nothing. So all the companies I was looking at were companies from the prior generation, the old stuff. And the old stuff was really not that interesting. And I found myself, though, spending time with the new internet companies. But back in 2003, the internet was a dirty word. No venture capitalist wanted to fund internet companies because that had just gone bust. You know, this was pets.com and Webvan, and the Yahoo was worthless almost at the time. And so, you know, and Google hadn't quite emerged yet. It was a company, but no one knew how great it was. And so some people did, but it was still early. But I loved these internet companies. So the only interesting ones were coming through, these brand new internet companies that no one had heard of, but everyone said, oh, those are, we don't do internet companies. Luckily at Excel, we had a practice, and they still do, of something called the prepared mind. And now most people do this, but Excel was fairly unique back then, which was to say, hey, what are we looking for? What do we think is going to happen? What do we think the next set of technologies are going to be, or the next set of companies? And what's going to make them successful, and have an idea so that when we see one that matches that, we can move very quickly and with conviction, and that we've already educated all of our partners about it. So when we see it and we bring it into the partners meeting, everyone goes, yep, that's it. We can move quickly. And so I did a prepared mind along with another partner of mine on the new internet, sort of what we called back then. It was sort of Web 2.0, but this sort of new internet stuff. And saying, hey, here's what I think is going to make these things work. It's when there's a community that emerges. This is all sounds obvious now, but it wasn't back then. It's right. Hey, there's going to be a new community that emerges around a site or a service, and that it sort of has these tentacles that reach into your life deeper and deeper as it grows. And so the analogy we used was actually back then was eBay, because that was one of the few successful companies, and how it created these communities, these micro communities in the different areas of collectibles. It created power sellers who made money on it, and their lives got more embedded in it. And so we said, if we see something like that, you know, what as a community? And so it was interesting. So that's when social media began to emerge.
That was informed by the experience of passing on Skype.
Part of it. Passing on Skype was, I didn't want to pass on Skype, for the record. It's a long story. But I tried to do it. It just a quick story on that. It was a very unusual investment because the two founders, Nicholas and Janus, were Estonian, and they were fugitives from the U.S. law. What I mean, in other words, they were not allowed to travel to the United States because they had started Kazaa, which was the European version of Napster, that was this illegal music file sharing company. They were being sued by the recording industry. I don't think they would have been arrested, but they would have been served with this lawsuit, so they didn't want to come. So we had to meet over video conference back at that time. And I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, not about the technology or the company.
Their location.
Their location, that I wouldn't disclose their whereabouts or their cell phone number. So because of that, and there's some weirdness around the intellectual property that I think people were uncomfortable, but it was clear the business was taking off, but it wasn't much of a community. It was a communication utility. You'd talk to people on it. And back then it wasn't video, it was just audio. You know, it was communication, but it felt thin. But then social media was interesting. So there was something called Friendster, which was sort of the first social network in a way in San Francisco that grew really quickly and then just died. Totally died. And, you know, they had gotten investments from Kleiner Perkins, my old firm, and Benchmark and these famous guys, and it just totally tanked. And so everyone thought social media was stupid. Friendster was known for, as you've heard this story, for being populated with, unfortunately, the sex trade, you know, prostitutes, right? So you go, and in fact, prostitutes in the Philippines, because they never figured out how to architect the site, the infrastructure of the service. And so they couldn't keep the site up during daylight hours in the US because the traffic kept crashing it. So when they could keep it up was daylight hours in Asia. And then and no one knew what to do on it because it had didn't have any features. And so it just began used for prostitution. And so then there was something called MySpace that was sort of that evolved. No, and I looked at MySpace carefully. I got a phone call from someone saying, look at MySpace, because they knew I was looking at this stuff. And they said, look at MySpace. It's sort of a Friendster with fewer prostitutes on it. And it's, you know, based in LA. And so I looked at that and actually I wanted to invest in MySpace, but at the time you really couldn't because it was owned by sort of this weird holding company and they weren't taking investments. So I didn't do it. To their credit, a firm called Redpoint figured out how to invest in them and bought a little stake in them. But again, luck. Very lucky that I didn't, because then I wouldn't have been able to invest in Facebook. So then Facebook came along, and it's a long story, but we'd heard about it at Stanford and that people were using it. And so I checked it out, and it was clear that what was unique about Facebook was there was actually a reason to be on it. Unlike, say, Friendster, where you'd sort of post a picture and your name and or maybe not your name, or MySpace, where you posted a fake profile or six profiles, you know, one of you dressed in drag, another one of you, you know, all of your different personalities. There were fake profiles, a lot of fake celebrity profiles in MySpace, whereas Facebook was totally different. The application was your life at college, just in university. You know, Facebook was really, in the early days, capacity constrained. So it grew so quickly, they couldn't add new universities to it as fast as they wanted. And back then, the way it was architected, that each university had a physical servers associated with it. So, hey, those three servers are for Harvard. Those two are for Florida. That one's for Stanford. And so there was a backlog of kids at, if you were at, you know, University of Illinois or Minnesota, and you wanted to be on there, you had to wait till Facebook launched your university. So what they did is they said, hey, look, there's a long list. If you want to move up the list and get launched sooner, send us your metadata. Someone needs to send us the list of your courses, the list of your dormitories, you know, all of this in electronic format. So that when we have it, when we launch University of Illinois, you immediately go on there and it's populated. You could say what dorm you're in. You can say what classes you're in with a drop-down menu. So the data is very clean. And then you immediately could see who else is in your dorm, who else is in your classes. You could connect with them and it becomes hyper viral, right? So there was context and a reason for you to be on there. Unlike Friendster, like, what are you supposed to do on Friendster? Well, I guess I'll have casual sex, as opposed to, you know, this is where I find out who's in my classes. I form study groups. I form student groups. There were people selling t-shirts out of the dorm room on it. So it was very quickly became your student life. And if you were not on it, you missed out on student life. And so this was what I was looking for. This was the tentacles of your daily life. The more you're on it, the more it sucks you in. And the user statistics at the time were insane.
When you say this is what I was looking for, like, was this argument part already of your prepared mind exercise? Or how did that prepared mind exercise prepared you to be able to take, I mean, I very aggressively pursued the investment in Facebook, which you actually end up like paying a high valuation for that time. So I want to understand what was the connection between that prepared mindset approach to the Facebook?
Yeah, because we said, hey, the things we were looking for were, one, it's, you know, inherently the usage of it is inherently viral. There were inherent network effects, which it obviously were, right? Like the minute you're on there, you want your friends to be on there. You invite them. You want to be on there to form groups, because a lot of the application itself was to form groups to do real things, to study, to, you know, other groups, to meet people. So there was this pull, and that, but then also this idea of tentacles that expand what the service is. So initially you get on there and it's just a student directory. It's just see a list of students. But then as you spend more time on there, you get to accomplish all of these other things and you begin asking the service to, or you hack it to do even other things it wasn't meant to, like selling t-shirts. And, you know, there was no electronic commerce functionality at the time, but people were using it. They would post shirts and they would put, you know, it's study group here tomorrow. It wasn't meant to be a study group service. So when you see that something is viral, it's engaged, and then people extend it and it extends into your life, that was what we were looking for. And, you know, and the usage statistics were insane. Basically the average part, 60% of the people would come back every day and they use it 3 or 4 hours a day. It was insane. And so what the prepared mind allows you to do is have conviction around something that other people on the surface dismiss. And everyone else, so Facebook was not a competitive investment. No one else wanted to do it. Everyone else turned it down. Really, all the other venture firms turned it down. Whatever they say, they turned it down. They were turned it down for a lot of reasons. You know, one was Sean Parker had a very interesting reputation. Watch the Social Network movie if you want to understand that. Maybe that's the only part of the movie that has even any basis in fact, was the Sean Parker pitch. And the rest of it is completely garbage. But, and the other reason was they thought, you know, Friendster had failed, so social networking was stupid. And they didn't understand how Facebook was very different than Friendster. But you had to use it and understand it. And then the second thing is they didn't understand how valuable it could be as a media business. Because, you know, the conventional wisdom was, hey, college students who use this thing, they're poor, they have no money, why advertise to them? But if you just dig into that a little bit and you ask anyone in the media business about college students, they'll say, no, they're the most valuable demographic in the world. U.S. college students, 18 to 25 years old, because that's when all of your purchase habits are formed. That's when you get your first bank account, your first credit card. You know, that's when they're forming relationships with you. They'll pay anything. And so they're like, look, if you could tell us you've got 70% of the U.S. college students in the world on this thing for 4 hours a day. Are you kidding me? This is an advertiser's dream. So even though they weren't making any money, I knew, okay, there's a business here. So what the prepared mind allows you to do is when other people just dismiss whole categories, well, that's stupid. You go, okay, well, why is it stupid? And when would it be not stupid, right? So it's understanding these differences is what a prepared mind is about. And so then we saw it, we could move very quickly. They didn't want to meet with us. They were going to take a little money from the Washington Post, actually. And so we had to convince them that, no, we'll do this. We're not going to waste your time. We believe it's valuable. And so there was had to go back to them a couple of times and do that. And you know, when they said no, and then we did it, but that was it. And then look, I tell you that was the lowest point in my venture capital career, however.
I wanted to double click on something, which is Mark Zuckerberg had a profile that was maybe very different from most startup founders, I'd say, until that date. I mean, today it's probably more similar to see college dropouts. And one of the lessons like your team at Accel had to internalize before investing in Facebook was that consumer companies could be founded by a different profile of founders, like unorthodox individuals, in comparison to the more reassuring engineers that founded, I guess, enterprise software startups that were more common at the time.
And I don't know how much, it's hard for me to look back and I don't remember how much of this I believed or knew then versus I formed this thesis later. They are very different. And so again, you have to have a prepared mind, not just about company ideas, but about people. Because every venture capitalist will tell you, well, we invest in the people, not the idea. And that is kind of true. There were other people who had a very similar idea to Mark, and Mark crushed them all, right? Why? Why did he crush MySpace? And why did Friendster fail? And I don't believe it's an accident. It wasn't that he just got lucky and had a better idea. He really is a lot smarter than just about everybody. So is Bill Gates. And so, you meet these people. So is Elon, right? I mean, look at Elon. Did Elon get lucky building rocket ships, and cars? So the thesis is that when Silicon Valley was about silicon and about infrastructure or even databases, this is deep infrastructure technology where you need a fair amount of experience to be able to do this and not lose a ton of your investors' money. Like making a microchip, it is an expensive, long process. And if you fuck up one thing along the way in the design, you could make $75 million of investment worthless. And you have to start over. And it's called do a respin the silicon. And it's super expensive. So the entrepreneurs have to be really experienced because no one wants to trust some young kid who's going to fuck it up and they blow through $75 million. Today they would, but not then. Back then, by the way, a Series A investment was like, so in my company, even in the height of the dot-com boom in Iron Planet, the Series A, the first checks were like $2.5 million each from Kleiner Perkins and Accel. I mean, it was really small, right? And that was considered a lot of money. Like, we gave you $2 million. Today, I do that personally in startups. It's like, it's just, so that was what you were looking for, someone experienced. But consumer net ones are really different. And if you're selling something to consumers, it's almost you're part artist because consumers have no idea what they want. They can't tell you. It's like selling to a baby.
It's much less of a science in comparison to like more.
Well, there is a science. It's just needs, only understood by a few, right? And so it's not everyone that wants to look at data or, I want to do a survey or I want to do a focus group and I want to ask people what they want. And you get shit products, excuse my language, you get terrible products doing it that way. You need to have a point of view. And the way you have a point of view is you generally build something for yourself. Hey, I would really want, me and my friends could really use this and it doesn't exist. As opposed to doing a survey like a business school student. They go and do these surveys. And what do people really need? And what's the problem I'm solving? And you do a design thinking workshop and you have post-it notes and it's okay. It's how you do build like a decent product, but to build something that takes off, it's in, you have this intuition and it's got to look different and be a little scary. Otherwise everyone would have already done it. Right. So Mark was so different. Like he had this view of what he was building that only in some ways he really understood. The very specific problem he was trying to solve was how do I stay in touch with a large number of friends at the same time without having to send emails and even texts, because that was really inefficient. He viewed a one-on-one communication as just inefficient. And he wanted an easy way to stay in touch with a lot of people. Honestly, probably because he's an introvert and individual conversations take a lot of energy for a guy like him and me. So he wanted it to be kind of like the Wall Street Journal newspaper, which at that time was famous when it was a real paper, that you could look at and see everything going on in the world on the left-hand side. So there was just a column on the left-hand side where there were summaries of all the important news stories and where you could go to learn more, as opposed to a normal newspaper, which would have a headline, but you had to kind of flip through. The Wall Street Journal was efficient. I could have looked down the left-hand side of the Wall Street Journal. It takes me 2 minutes. I know what happened in the world. And if I want more, I could get more. And his idea was, well, I kind of want to do that for all my friends. Because newsfeed didn't exist, right? Twitter didn't exist. And so he was inventing this concept of a newsfeed for your friends, but he didn't explain it that way. I just kind of found out later that's how he was thinking about it. And it only came out when we'd be in board meetings. And in the early days, MySpace was killing Facebook. It was growing much faster. It was all over the world. It had many more age groups. Facebook was just for college students in the US. And we thought that was because he was too slow. And MySpace could do all these things that Facebook couldn't do. You could have multiple profiles. You could embed a YouTube video in your profile. You could customize it. Whereas Facebook was kind of this very, what we would call Spartan, boring thing, just for college. And so we'd say, when are we going to be able to embed a YouTube video in a Facebook profile? And he'd say, I don't know, and I don't fucking care, because that's not what we're about. You know, all the engineers are too busy working on feed and platform. And I remember saying, what the fuck is feed? Because newsfeed didn't exist. We couldn't visualize this. Like, what is, and he didn't bother to tell us about it. He's like, we're building this thing called feed. You'll love it. Okay. So none of us really believed it, but he had in his head exactly what he's doing. He said, we are a communication utility. We are about efficient communication. MySpace is about self-expression. And so he knew, and so he could resist all the other bullshit. And this is what's important for a consumer entrepreneur, is you have this vision of the thing you're trying to build, and you have to fight to keep it that thing. Great consumer entrepreneurs or artists, you have to fight to keep your vision the way you envision it and not allow the business people to ruin it. It's a lot like being a movie director, right? Like the great movie directors have this vision, and then the suits from the studio want to change the ending. They want to put certain actors or actresses in there. They want to make it like this, and they ruin the movie. And so we were those suits. We were the movie studio. And Mark was the director who kind of said, no, I'm keeping it. And I could tell stories forever about how many ideas that I gave him that he turned down and said, that's stupid because we're building this. One or two we actually took, but most of them were bad. So that's the difference. And so you need to, and those people are usually young and they're usually overly self-confident and they haven't been ruined by the world yet. And beaten down, you know, the most arrogant people in the world are really young, in many cases, because they don't know any better.
I love the director's metaphor, because it, what you described sounds a lot like stories I've read about James Cameron and Christopher Nolan of how they are when they're working on their movies and their scripts. And it sounds like very, very similar. So how did this experience working with Mark influence the character traits you look for in a founder? Like, did you suddenly start looking for Mark Zuckerbergs?
Well, if you do that, you're not going to make many investments, right? Because there aren't many. You know, he was a once in a generation. I mean, it's a very small list of people like him, right? As Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, and now I guess you'd say Elon and Mark. And I mean, there's just a very, very small list of those people who have that, both the technical ability and the intuition. And I mean, there are schemers like a Travis Kalanick, you know, who take advantage of things. But in terms of the true understanding of product and market and consumer and technology, like there's so few. It did change what I looked for, mostly to the bad, because you want someone who's stubborn and has a point of view and, you know, in many cases young, but there's a lot of young, stubborn people who aren't any good, will lead you off a cliff. So it's a real high risk way to do things. You know, and I made a bunch of mistakes. I mean, probably made some terrible investments after Facebook, because it was a very difficult investment to do early in your career in some ways, because it was so big and going after such a massive market. Anything else just seemed too small. And that was a problem. Like I couldn't get excited after that about some vertical market, small market SaaS company. And there were a bunch of those, and people made their careers doing those. And those just seemed so boring to me. So I would go after some of these really big ideas like Groupon and other things that, you know, you go after something really big, but it can be a real challenge. I loved Andrew Mason, though, who was the Groupon CEO. And I still think he's brilliant and doesn't get the credit he deserves. He saw the world through a very different prism and was a really unique individual, someone I really like. The business grew so fast, it was impossible for him to keep it under control. But I think he was one of those brilliant guys but didn't get enough credit.
In the book, the Power Law, Sebastian Mallaby, the author, tells the story of how you had to chase Mark and the Facebook executives in order to invest in them. So you definitely put a lot of work into making this deal happening. But you, as you said a few minutes ago, it was one of the low points in your careers. Why was arguably one of the best venture investments in history such a low point for you?
Well, it reminded me that I wasn't an entrepreneur. And they were, because it was really after that that I saw they were having all the fun. They were building this company. It was growing quickly. I had all these new ideas of things to launch that I wanted to do with them. And I'm the investor guy. So I'd show up and we'd talk about all this stuff and then I'd leave. I'm the investor guy. And that sucked. You know, I thought about quitting to go join them. Maybe I should have. Being a venture capitalist just isn't nearly as much fun as what they were doing, in my opinion. So that was a real difficult time. I was like, wow, that's the best it gets as an investor, supposedly. I mean, even then, it's like, this is an interesting investment, especially at that time when there was nothing interesting going on. It's like, okay, this is really interesting, but this is it. I mean, as an investor, this is as happy as I get. I'm on to the next one, you know? Well, what's your next deal? You know, what's after that? It's like, well, I'd rather go spend the next 10 years working on this thing. And I'll never forget, there was a conversation with Mark. It's a long story. Yahoo was trying to buy the company and he was trying to figure out whether to sell him to Yahoo. And he didn't want to sell to Yahoo. And I remember he's like, well, what do you think? And I said, well, look, you are however old he was at the time, 19 or 20. You would sell, you'll have $300 million, which at that time seemed like a lot of money. And you could do whatever you want in your life at 19. Do you want to become a senator? What do you want to do? $300 million. You could do whatever you want. So if that's important to you, you know, you can sell now and do that. Well, what do you want to do? And he said, I want to do exactly what I'm doing right now. I want to keep building this company. This is what I want to do. I can't think of anything else I want to do. This is what I want to do. I love doing this. So why would I sell it? You know, why would I do anything but what I'm doing? And I thought, okay, you know, there's your answer. And that resonated a lot with me because I'm the type of person who really enjoys going deep and building things. That's what I was about. And so this idea that, well, on to the next investment, spend your week meeting 25 more entrepreneurs, saying no to all 25 and keep doing that until you find your next one was really depressing for me. Because it wasn't about building, it was about finding the next deal and then, you know, you make money. But, you know, and that kind of led me eventually to this Latin America stuff, you know, skip ahead, which I think is important, which was, you know, why did I do Latin America, you know, years later, essentially because it feels like building something again, building the region, building an ecosystem that doesn't exist. And probably, you know, one of the reasons it is existing. I mean, there's other people, Kazakh, Monashi's great. I mean, they're really doing the work, but I'm doing a lot with them. And, you know, I was an investor in Kazakh's first fund. Hernan's my business school classmate. I introduced some new investors. I did diligence calls with investors to help them raise their funds and advise them. And Monashi's very similar. And then invested in companies alongside them. And there was no ecosystem here in Latin America in 2010, 2011. There was Mercado Libre, one sort of successful company, and that was it.
I want to wrap up the Facebook phase of your life because you mentioned it was sort of a depressing experience in a sense, despite being at the same time so successful. Like how did you, I know that shaped you as a person? Any important changes?
A couple of things. One is I decided I was going to practice the venture business in a way that I wanted to practice it and not necessarily the way you're supposed to, you know, and I had conversations with some of the founding partners at Excel about it, which was, this sucks. Maybe I should go be an entrepreneur. Maybe I should go leave and join Faith or do something. And they said, well, you know, there's not just one playbook for how you have to be a venture capitalist. You know, you don't just have to do it one way. There's a lot of different ways you could do it. You know, look at Vinod Khosla or how he would do it, or look at Anil Bushri at Greylock, right? He basically starts companies, you know, and doesn't do many investments. He does a few, but kind of helps run them. And so I thought, okay, I'm just going to do it the way I want to do it, which is try to invest in areas that both I think can be big as well as interest me and work that way. And look, I've made enough money or I'll make enough money for my partners that I think I've earned that freedom. And if that doesn't work for them, well, then I'll kind of do it more on my own. So it gave me a lot of independence to find freedom to not do things just the way everyone else does. A typical young person who gets in the venture capital business, they want to know, how do I become a partner in the firm? What do I need to do to, quote, succeed? And, you know, I need to do investments, and then one of those investments have to work and hopefully not lose money. And, you know, I didn't want to be a venture capitalist to begin with. So to be honest, I didn't give a shit. So I was going to do things about making partner. I was going to do things that I thought were interesting and that I believed in. And if those worked, great. If they didn't, I'd probably have to find another job. But I wasn't going to do something just because, you know, just to make partner. That felt artificial. Because what happened, that's how these mediocre venture capitalists do it, which is, I just need to find a deal that makes money. And then they keep doing these like medium bad deals. And they never do the great ones, because the great ones are scary. They're really scary. And you could, you know, Facebook, that was the highest valuation it was done at the time. People thought we were stupid. There was an anonymous quote the day the deal was announced on VentureWire that said, that deal doesn't have a prayer, from an anonymous person. Because everyone had passed on it at a high price. And then there were people who called up my friends at the firm and said, what happened to Kevin? Why'd you let him do that deal? That was fucking ridiculous. You know, and again, I thought like, okay, so if I get fired, maybe that's even great. But I'm going to do things I believe in. And that's my advice to a lot of young people in jobs, which is, they always want to ask me, well, how do I be successful, or how do I make partner, or how do I get promoted? It's funny. The answer to that is to not try to get promoted. The answer to that is to try to do amazing stuff. And if you do amazing stuff, you're going to get promoted. And like, if you focus on what you believe in and think is amazing, everything else will work out. If you do something just because you think it's what your boss wants, or but you don't believe in it, that usually doesn't work out. So I kind of tell people, if you're not doing something where you're afraid you're going to get fired, just a little bit maybe, then you're probably not doing anything interesting. If you're not willing to take a risk with your career a little bit, and that you could look stupid if what you're doing doesn't work out, you're not doing anything very meaningful. And back to Facebook, you know, look at Mark. I mean, he bet the company over and over. He bet the company on buying Instagram for, you know, $1 billion on the eve of the IPO, when it had, I mean, everyone thought it was stupid. It's the whole company now, that and WhatsApp, you know, and he paid a ton for WhatsApp at the time that, again, seemed stupid. And he also bet the company on the metaverse, but hey, you can understand, right? Like he's going to constantly try to move it forward. It's like, if we're not moving forward, we're dying. We're moving backward. You're either moving forward or you're moving backward. And so I think with your career, you need to have that attitude. Like, if you're not pushing yourself into something that's uncomfortable, where you're worried about either getting fired or having a major reputational problem, if it doesn't work, probably shouldn't do it. Now, that I have a very strong view that these should be ethical things, and that these are things that make the world better. So I don't believe in, you know, there were a lot of investment trends that I hate, like sports betting and crypto, and that I've never done. And I think they're bad for the world. I don't mean that, but I mean challenges and risks. And if you're not taking challenges and risks, you're never going to get it. You'll be mediocre, and maybe you will get promoted to partner, and you'll be a mediocre partner. You know, life is too short. And it is short. I'm 50 now. I realize how short it is.
Speaking of taking risks in your career, you've supported startups ecosystem internationally, as you were saying, in the case of Latin America, but you also, I mean, helped kickstart Accel's investments in India and China, but you took a special interest in Latin America. And I know that currently you spend a good chunk of your time helping entrepreneurs out there.
I didn't do much in China, by the way, to be clear. I really didn't get that started. But India, I spent a lot of time, or a fair amount of time.
It's like, why Latin America? What makes you so optimistic about the region? Because when I hear you, it sounds like even more optimistic than people, leaders from the region.
Well, I mean, I just have a different perspective, right? You know, yes, there's ups and downs, but you just need to have a 10 or 20 year view, right? And so for me, I began going down there in 2010, because it was the Brazil in particular, not all of Latin America, but Brazil was the second largest market in the world for Facebook and Groupon in revenue, not just users. And I was like, why? Because, you know, your average American in 2010 didn't know anything about Brazil. And we basically think everything south of the border is sort of like Mexico, except
Mexico. Yeah.
And, you know, it's like this big giant.
There's a meme of that.
And I was like, I had a little more experience than that, but not much. And so, you know, I'd been to Venezuela so I went to Brazil and said, what is this? And I was just shocked by, you know, how huge it was and diverse economy and relatively developed. And, you know, but also, so just had all, it was a big market, a lot of potential, very dense also, like most of the economy is in the southeast of the country. And I just loved the people, you know, there were a lot of talented people and they were just much easier to work with than, I won't name other countries, but other countries where people tend to be more guarded or defensive or don't like to collaborate, or the, you know, the style of negotiation is everything is I take from you, and as opposed to like, how do we build something together, right? And so I love that about the Brazilians, that they were entrepreneurial people who wanted to build stuff with teams. They were collaborative. Now, there weren't very many engineers, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a long talent gap, but I thought, well, if you take a 7 to 10 year view, this is starting 2010, you know, long-term view, and we begin to build the ecosystem, that eventually there'll be something here. And I'm patient, you know, I was still young. And as we talked about, and there was some, and I liked the Monashis and Kazakh people. And so began getting started and making investments. And that time frame turned out to be about right. You know, things didn't get really interesting until 10 years in, but now there's an ecosystem. And now, yeah, things are difficult, but that's just because 2021 and 2020 were not reality. You had an inexperienced people assuming raising money was easy and doing dumb business models at high prices, and spending a lot of money. But the fundamental companies, there's some great ones that are going to be really valuable. I mean, not just Nubank. Quinto Andar in Brazil is going to be really valuable. Gympass is all over the world now. Nuvem Shop, Flash, you know, these are going to be valuable companies. Hopefully Creditas, so I'm not in that one. 10 years ago, 2010, this was unimaginable. So I'm pretty excited. I feel like we built something. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pain and ups and downs between here and there. But from where I sit, the ecosystem is beyond my wildest dreams for where it would be.
That's awesome. I talked to a fellow Peruvian, Diego Ontaneda, founder of the Latin American Leadership Academy, mostly known as Lala, who you support and I think participating in his board. And he said that unlike other donors, you operate more like a venture investor than a donor, in the sense that you fully trust him as a social entrepreneur to make the decisions. What concepts and skills do you think translate from the world of venture capital to the world of philanthropy?
Not many. I'm not very good at it. I think we're still learning, you know, I think the main, the way we operate is exactly what Diego said, which is you try to find great people and support them to do what they think is right. The idea for what Lala is has evolved over time, different than what we thought it would be in the beginning. And there were times when, you know, even we disagreed and said, hey, should we do this or should something else be a bigger priority? And then ultimately Diego and his co-founder, David, convinced us, nope, this is the right path. And we trust them. And I think it's the way it has to be. It's either that or you're running it yourself, right? Because if you don't trust them to do what they want to do, then and instead you say, nope, you need to do my idea. You need to implement my idea. They become your employees effectively as the donor. And then you lose all accountability because now the idea has become yours. It's not theirs. And they probably won't stay and continue to do it. You know, so it's just not a great dynamic. And it's very difficult as a foreigner, as a donor, to know what the right thing is to do. I mean, they're the ones working with, in our case, students from Latin America. What right do I have to tell them how to do that? And so for us, also in philanthropy, we tend to believe that most of the mistakes are made by donors who impose ideas from, I don't know, a white paper or a university or their own life to a foreign country, and they ruin it. And there's so many examples of this. We see it. We lived in Africa for a while on a sabbatical, lived in Latin America, but in Africa in particular, we could see what foreign NGOs and how stupid they were on the ground in Kenya or South Africa. And we didn't want to be one of those people. We wanted to work with local people who said, nope, this is what we need. And we go, okay, how do we make that great? How do we help you make that great and make it permanent? And so that's, we view our role is to help them make what they already want to do great by helping them hire great people and, you know, raise money and stuff and make it sustainable so that, you know, again, usually money's involved or business model or thinking so that it can last way beyond their lifetimes. And so that's kind of our role. And the other thing we need to keep in mind is, unlike in the, and this is where it's different, this is where the venture capital model can be bad for NGOs, is that in venture capitalists, you're working with entrepreneurs where the idea is if they're successful, you know, they make a gazillion dollars if they're really successful. Diego running Lala is not going to make a gazillion dollars. This is not saying that Lala isn't great or that it's not built to do that. That's not what it does. It's helping people. So Diego has given his life so far to this. Think about that. And Diego went to Stanford Business School. Diego could have done a lot of things with his life where he could have been very comfortable. But he chose to go back to Latin America. He worked for McKinsey for all. He chose to go back to Latin America and do this, knowing he wasn't going to make any money, because he loves the people and he wants to give back. I mean, think about that. Think about what kind of human being does that. So a lot of the interactions we have in the venture capital model have a different implicit assumption. The relationship is a little different, right? Like, you can hold, the accountability is different. They're okay with a certain amount of pain because, you know, they took a bunch of your money for a chance to get really rich. So there's this, it's a different handshake. In an NGO, these are just incredibly wonderful who've almost volunteered. And so, yeah, you know, they're going to make mistakes. They're going to have challenges just like an entrepreneur would, but you need to react to those differently, you know, in an NGO than you would say as a board member of a for-profit company, where you say, you know, in a board member of a for-profit company, if things stay broken, they're stewards of all this investor capital. There's a fiduciary responsibility to like return money. I mean, it's more of a tougher environment, right? And applying that mindset to an NGO, while it can help the NGO be great, it also, in many ways, I keep having to remind myself, it's not fair. I mean, it's not fair. These guys work so hard for so little that I personally have to find myself having a different mode of helping them be great.
Speaking of the venture capital model, one of the questions I often ask myself as a US-based VC investing in Latin America is where VC is the right financial model. And it's because I frequently meet great founders whose businesses will grow to $10 million, whose businesses just aren't a fit for venture capital. And the truth is, I mean, LATAM's GDP per capita is a tenth of the US, so there really aren't a lot of billion-dollar markets, but there's still a lot of big problems to solve. And I often wonder if there should be like some alternative financing model for tech entrepreneurship in Latin America, but also in general in emerging economies, where you don't have the depth of the capital markets and the market size that allows you to, I mean, lose money for, you know, the first 2, 3, or 4 years, which the truth is a privilege for most Latin American startups. What do you think about this?
I think you're right. That's why the SoftBank model, you know, chasing Latin America, it was never made any sense. And you have to be very capital efficient in down there because the exits are going to be smaller. And so if there is an exit at all. And so, you know, that's why the big money burning, you know, low gross margin businesses never made any sense to me down there. You have to find something that has a good profitable business model. And there's only a few sectors of the economy that can do that, right? But if you do find them, they could be pretty big. So the other thesis, that the counter argument to some of that is that, yeah, Latin America's overall economy, if you combine it all, is a fraction of the US. But if you're successful, you can dominate it. So why Mercado Libre is a very valuable company. Why? Even though, you know, it's smaller, because it kind of dominated. And so if you can be the number one player by a long margin, you can make up for the market being smaller. Whereas in the US, you might have six competitors or four, you know, could do well. So the problem that we had in Latin America was people funding the seventh version of the same idea. It's just stupid because the market's not big enough. So to be honest, my advice to Kazakh and Monashees, for instance, was to always collude. It's like, look, if Monashees did the Series A of a company, instead of funding the Series A of a competitor or a clone, which I think was stupid, fund the Series B of the same company. So there's one winner. You know, and you saw this all the time. And there's a seed fund that I won't name in Brazil that developed a reputation for just cloning ideas that would come in. So an idea would come in, they'd pitch this seed fund, and the seed fund would say, well, we'll just have an entrepreneur do that exact same idea at one-tenth the price. And then these were just dumb. And they would trash, and most of those have failed. But meanwhile, they would sort of trash the market for everyone. So Latin America is not big enough for that. But do I agree with you on that there's a lot of companies that are nice businesses? For sure. And that's true in the US too, by the way. You know, because a venture capitalist is looking for a 10, 20, 30, 100x return. You don't get that by taking dividend checks every year on profits. But you know what? There's other investors who are looking for that. And, you know, people who invest in restaurants and, you know, bars and, you know, that do really well. And so, you know, I think you could create, and so you could probably create a vehicle. So actually one of my business school classmates did this because he saw this. He started something called Alpine Investors, and he is now the largest employer of Stanford Business School graduates. Like he's the biggest hirer of them who come out, I think. And he's created this model where he finds all these tiny businesses that are run really well, that are profitable, that generate cash. And he drops in these Stanford Business School young, hungry guys to be CEO because, you know, the owner wants to sell. And they run it, and they run it efficiently, and they build profits. And then their fund just collects the profits from these companies. And it is a fantastic fund and performs as well as a fund. It's a lot of work because he constantly has to hire these young guys to be CEOs and fix these things. But it's beautiful. And so I think someone could do that in all these businesses in Latin America. You know, it's basically mini private equity, right? But it is what it is. But, you know, small scale. And your advice to people isn't necessarily to get big, it's to get profitable. And they don't have to ever sell. You just collect the, you know, fraction of the profits. And yeah, I mean, I think that's, hey, Enzo, you want to go do that? Maybe you should. I mean, go talk to my friend Graham and... Graham Weaver's his name, and do the version of that in Latin America.
I have a friend that's working in that. Lucas Lopatin is Argentinian. He has a sort of company builder slash fund. It's called IndieBuild, and he's investing in basically technology, digital companies going after these small niche markets that wouldn't qualify for VC investment. And he's doing well. And I've been discussing with him about this idea a lot, and that's why I always have it. I wanted to get your perspective on it. You're spending more and more time in philanthropy than in venture. Yeah, more than as a tech investor. Why do you have such a sense of urgency, and what have you learned about yourself through this philanthropy work?
Well, my wife runs our foundation. I would say she provides a lot of the moral compass in our family, you know, in terms of, because once, you know, we've done well. We've made more money than we could spend, than we'd ever want to give to our kids, than we'd ever want to give to the grandkids. Existing to make more money feels mentally ill or something. Like, I just don't get it. I don't understand it, but I think people do it for, I don't know, whatever reason. I have no desire to own a sports team, I think is the only reason I could see wanting more money. And so, and we do want to make the world better. I mean, that was why I wanted to be an entrepreneur. It wasn't to get rich and famous. It was to build something that you're proud of. What are you proud of? And we took a year in 2012 with the family. We took the kids out of school, and we spent the year living in a few other places in the world. And we lived in Cape Town, South Africa, Kyoto, Japan, and Rio de Janeiro for about 3 months each, just to, for the family and for us. And Africa in particular left a big impression, right? That there was so much that people were suffering for such stupid reasons and for such small amounts of money that, and if you work with some really bright people there, you could change things. And I find that rewarding. Like getting another kid from Stanford rich at some point loses its meaning. Instead of, you know, so here's an example of a kid we work with. There's a school that we support, actually started by a couple of Stanford Business School graduates, called the African Leadership Academy. And that's where LALA, the Latin American Leadership Academy, is based on. In fact, Diego used to work at African Leadership Academy. And so the idea was, let's find a bunch of high potential, but probably really poor young Africans, put them in this great program, teach them leadership, you know, political skills, history, as well as maybe entrepreneurship. And then someday, maybe some of them will go back and want to run their countries, like literally, like presidents, foreign minister, whatever. But it'll take a long time. And so we found, you know, we began supporting this school and we said, hey, look, someday when one of these kids wants to go run for office, like actually do it, not just get a job in the US, but actually go back and change their country. Have them call us and then we'll help them because we want to see this happen. And so one kid heard this and eventually called us, and he was homeless. He became a great student. So you get out remote, 4 hours away from Nairobi, you know, put into school, became a great student. And then there's a lot of stories I could tell about this kid, but basically he, you know, got admitted to the best boarding school in Kenya based on merit on his test scores, could not afford to go, even though it was a scholarship, because he couldn't afford the bus fare to get to Nairobi. It was about $80, couldn't afford it. So the foster father, the father who took him in, not his real father, said, well, you could stay here and go to the school here. And that's just fine. And he said, no, I belong in that boarding school. And the father said, well, you don't have the money. So you can't, if you're not going to go to school, you can't stay in my house. So he got kicked out of the house and he begged in the streets for 6 weeks until he got the $80 to go to the boarding school. So he made it to the boarding school. By the time he got to the boarding school, they'd given away his spot. He didn't have the spot anymore. I'm here, I'm paying. And the guy said, well, you don't have your spot. So he slept out in front of the headmaster's office for 2 weeks until they gave him a spot at the school. And then he became the best student at the school. And then with just a couple months left before graduation, there was election violence in Kenya. And this is 2007, they had these very violent elections. And he looked on TV at the violence, which were all these young people holding machetes and threatening people and politicians. And he recognized a couple of them, because they had been in the street gang with him, and said, I know these kids, what are they doing? And he called them, he found them and said, why are you with the machetes? And they said, because some guy paid us a couple dollars to do it. And this made him so upset, he dropped out of school, started a nonprofit to work on youth unemployment issues. And this is who this kid is. And then ALA heard about this kid. They went to his boarding school looking for students. This was their first year. And they wanted these high potential students. And the headmaster said, well, there's one kid you should go after, but he's not here. He left. This is the kid you should find. So they found him. He became part of the first ALA class and made it all the way to Yale in the United States. Got a graduate degree at Yale, international relations. And at that point, he could do anything, like Diego, right? Could have gone and said, nope, I'm going to go back, not just to Kenya, but to my impoverished, poor state in Kenya. And I'm going to run for Senate. I want to be a senator and I want to fix this stuff. Because Kenya is not a poor country. It's just all the money stolen. Kenya had the same GDP per capita as South Korea in 1950. Just bad management. By the way, quick aside, Argentina.
Argentina had the US 100 years ago. Yeah.
Bad leadership, right? A century of Peronism will destroy it, right? So he reached out and said he wanted to run for Senate. He got connected with us through ALA and we told him we'd help him. And we did. He ran as a 26-year-old. He lost. The guy he lost to died in office a year later. So he ran again and was probably going to win, but elections are not exactly free and open in Kenya, you know? And he was running as an independent against like the main party and lost, but probably won. And that was it, right? He said, okay, I'm done. I'm going to go start a business. We're going to help him do that. But he was still famous in his area for running. And so because he was famous, he was still a threat to the local politicians. So they tried to murder him. But then a year ago, he got a call from the president and the kind of number two guy who knew him he was kind of famous and said, we want you to run for Senate again, except this time you're going to do it as part of our party. We're going to give you the nomination. So you'll win. You should do it. We believe in you. We want you to help us with the youth vote. So he ran again and he won with 87% of the vote. And he's now probably the youngest senator in Kenya. And but this was 7 years it took this to do it. 7 years. So that's it. That's what we love to do. And, you know, take this money we've made and put it back into the young people of these places and hope they create something great. And that's it. That's what we're motivated by right now.
Kevin, thanks so much for this hour and a half and all the work you do for my region. It's really inspiring and selfless all that you're doing. And I've been like really moved by all the work you're doing. So thanks a lot for that. And thanks for the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Enzo. I hope this is sort of interesting for your listeners. Lo siento por no hablar español, pero, you know.
You're doing much important work than learning Spanish for Latin America. Don't worry.
I just don't practice it. And you should hear my Portuguese. It's even worse.
Now falo Portuguese.
Falo un poco Portuguese. Mas.
Thanks, Kevin. It was awesome.
All right, take care.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.